It's Sunday, July 25th, and this is For Good Reason.
Welcome to For Good Reason. I'm DJ Grothy. For Good Reason is the radio show and the podcast of the James Randi Educational Foundation, an international nonprofit whose mission is to advance critical thinking, mostly about pseudoscience, the paranormal, the supernatural. Now about this week's interview. My guest is Eugenie Scott, a physical anthropologist. She's been the director of the National Center for Science Education for 20 years, a former president of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists, and a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She's one of the nation's leading defenders of the theory of evolution and a vocal critic of creationism and intelligent design theory. She's the author of the widely used and comprehensive textbook Evolution versus Creationism. And she's been a leader of Bay Area Skeptics, the San Francisco Area Skeptics Organization, for many years, in addition to being a leader in the skeptics movement for decades. Welcome to For Good Reason, Dr. Eugenie Scott.
Hello. Very happy to be here.
Eugenie, I want to start off with the basic challenge that some people give to your work. Rather than just letting ordinary, everyday, run-of-the-mill folks believe what they want to believe, rather than letting parents have their kids be taught the way they want them to be taught, you're saying, and in fact your whole work in life is set up around this idea that schools should teach only one explanation of life's origins in the science classrooms, and to many ordinary folks that seems kind of anti-democratic. I'm not saying I agree with it, but you know, the argument is that this is America, people have a right to believe what they want to, and who are you, Dr. Eugenie Scott, to shove your theory down everyone else's throats?
And that is precisely the way it is spoken by many people. We've received many letters to us and emails along those lines, and I see letters to the editor like that all the time. It's conflating two very important things. One is people do, fortunately, in the United States, have the right to believe anything they want in terms of their philosophical or religious beliefs. Wonderful, we have the First Amendment, which gives us freedom of religion. That's not the same thing as the decision as to what is taught in the public school science classroom, because the job of the high school teacher or middle school teacher, where these topics generally arise, is to present the consensus view of the scientific community. What you do in middle school and high school at the K-12 level in general is set a foundation for understanding the basics. Now, if you want to have creationism taught in the public schools, if you want to stop the teaching of evolution in the public schools, which are kind of two sides of the same coin, Your job really is to convince the scientific community that you've got a better explanation. And as it happens, the scientific community has a very good explanation. Living things had common ancestors. That's what evolution is all about. And we also have very good explanations of the various mechanisms like natural selection that bring about this common ancestry. And if you want to challenge that, great. But you don't challenge it at the high school level. You challenge it at the university level, at the professional science level. You convince the professional scientists that you have a better mousetrap, so to speak, Michael Behe. And then, like all other scientific ideas, which are certainly capable of changing, it's going to trickle down into the K-12 system. But what happens is that the teaching of science gets politicized in our country. And so people are proposing that evolution should be dropped or that creationism should be brought in at the high school and middle school level, not because they're valid sciences, but because there are political processes that determine the curriculum content.
And basically, they're zeroing in on the science classroom because it's easier to get changes
occurring at the high school level where you can stack a school board than it is in the scientific literature where you have to have, where the best ideas win, the best arguments are peer-reviewed, et cetera.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I find history fascinating. The history of the creation and evolution controversy is something that I've long been interested in, even before I got this job at NCSC, and that was a long time ago. But the history is very interesting because good old Henry Morris, who really is the father of the creationist movement in the United States, back in the 1960s was trying to convince the scientific community that special creationism, the basically a Genesis view, could be supported through scientific evidence. I mean, that was the nature of his book, The Genesis Flood, which attempted to show scientifically that Noah's flood actually was an historical event, and that geology would support this. And of course, the scientific community took a look at this and said, "No, here is why you're wrong. A, B, C, D, E, etc." And then a little bit later on, the intelligent design folks came in, and they didn't really get going until the late 80s and the early 90s. I mean, they've been around longer than most people think. But the intelligent design people started out by trying to convince the scientific community that intelligent design was a scientific idea rather than just a religious idea. And the scientific community took a look at what they said and said, no, here's where you're wrong, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So having failed to convince the scientific community, proponents of creation science and proponents of intelligent design have fallen back to the strategy of trying to go directly to the classroom, pressuring the teachers, pressuring the school boards, pressuring the legislatures to try to get their views accepted, even though they have not earned that right to be taught by having passed through the filter of science.
But the argument there is that they can't pass through the filter of science because what you're calling consensus science is actually this unelected elite who are calcified in their view and not open to new ideas, the kind of priesthood of science charge that even great evidence coming from ID or from creationism, mostly from ID, I guess they would argue, you know, that they would say, well, a scientist, what you're calling consensus, is actually just closed-minded groupthink that can't be penetrated.
Well, that's what they say, but that is refutable by showing the many times that scientific explanations have changed and are changing. You can pick up just about any copy of Science or Nature or Cell or any of the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, any of the major world scientific journals today, and find plenty of evidence that science is not moribund. It is not a priesthood that comes up to a conclusion and hangs on to it beyond all evidence. There are plenty of challenges to accepted views. Now, there have not been any successful challenges to the idea that the planets go around the sun for a really long time, okay? This consensus in astronomy is that geocentrism is here to stay. It's probably true. The consensus in biology and geology is that the universe has changed over time and that living things have descended with modification from common ancestors. There hasn't been a successful challenge to that, although certainly there are many efforts. But just bringing a challenge doesn't give you the warrant to assume that you're correct. And just like geocentrism, common ancestry is probably here to stay. On the other hand, the burden of proof is on those who challenge evolution or geocentrism, come up with a better explanation, and this is what they failed to do.
Mm. Eugenie, in addition to being a longtime leading voice for science education, you're also one of the leaders in this worldwide skeptics movement. You're a leader of the Bay Area Skeptics, a local skeptical organization there in the San Francisco area. You serve on the advisory committee for PSYCOP, now called the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. So let me ask you, skepticism is not just science. It's not just science advocacy or education. It's different than the work you do at NCSC. Has your work in skepticism ever undercut your science education work, which has a much broader appeal?
I don't think so, because what skepticism is all about is looking at claims of the paranormal, at claims of things which are claimed to be scientific, but which actually don't measure up to how we understand science, either in terms of the data of science, the conclusions of science, or science as a way of knowing, science as a method. And I actually got interested in skepticism because of my interest in creationism, which is a real classic example of something that claims to be scientific, but which fails on both content and method. Mm. And so, and my interest in skepticism has been in this traditional skeptics approach. In that sense, obviously, science is very important. Science as a method is important. And critical thinking is important because that's important both to science education, wearing my NCSE hat, and it's obviously essential to the public understanding of science kind of interest that I have through my my skeptics work.
Mm. I'm with the skeptics, maybe increasingly a minority. I don't know. I don't want to maybe draw lines in the sand, but I'm with the number of skeptics who say that the skeptic movement should mostly be about just two things. One, and you touched on both of these, furthering the public understanding, public appreciation of science, and two, promoting critical thinking in general, not just critical thinking about a set of claims, but in general, the skeptics movement wants to promote critical thinking in society.
But I think also I would like to add to that the evaluation of extraordinary claims, because I think that that's part of the public understanding of science interest that many of us have, and it's a serious matter because there are a lot of people who are suffering both medically and financially and other ways we could list because of claims that are said to be scientific, but actually which have no scientific foundation, and yet are believed in. And obviously this also reflects our common interest in critical thinking. Maybe if we thought more critically about these things, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to direct our interests toward these ideas, which I think are very injurious, or can be very injurious to the public.
Right. The harm question, that undue credulity hurts people, that fuels the skeptics movement. And yes, we focus on the paranormal, the pseudoscientific, testable supernatural claims, all that stuff, because those kinds of claims often result in harm. But what I was getting at is, if that's the focus of the skeptics movement, or should be, you know, public understanding and appreciation of science, promotion of critical thinking, using the focus on the paranormal and pseudoscience kind of as a teaching method, my question to you is, how do you think it's working out for the skeptics movement? You've been involved for decades. The skeptics movement's been around for 30 years. Is it working?
I think so. I think we can be quite pleased with what has happened in the skeptics movement, particularly with the advent of the Internet and a lot of the communication opportunities that the Internet has provided. Back in the old days, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even early 80s, before the Internet really hit its stride as the communication medium it is today, basically skepticism was a paper-based phenomenon. There was the Skeptical Inquirer, and then a little bit later on, Shermer's journal magazine, The Skeptic, came about. Mm-hmm. And there were conferences, and there were opportunities for people to get together, but they were few and far between. And I believe the skeptics movement was a lot smaller back then. Now, since the opportunities, and I think JREF has been a real leader in using the web to reach new ears, shall we say, new eyes, maybe because it's the Internet, a new population, and bless your hearts, a younger population too, which is desperately needed. I think we have expanded quite a bit, and I think getting the message that, you know, look, we have to consider some of these extraordinary claims very carefully. Is this particular practice or medicine really going to help grandma feel better, or really going to help my arthritis? I don't have arthritis, but, you know, if that's the idea. Or is there something fishy going on? Is this product really going to solve our energy problem? Or is it just a perpetual motion machine? How can we evaluate these things?
So all of that's kind of the consumer protection mission of skepticism's work.
Yeah, and I think that kind of consumer protectionism approach that you mentioned really has spread more widely. It's spread more widely because more people have been able to find out about it on the web, and they are also interested in it, and it's just, it's expanded the audience hugely. It's really great. Not that we've reached everybody who needs to be reached, nor does everybody who is interested in skepticism and who discovered it, perhaps through the web, necessarily know everything they need to know to be our missionaries, so to speak, to help the public at large become more scientifically aware.
Right. Certainly, the skeptic's work is never done. I want to backtrack a little and talk to you about this, I think, this odd place that you specifically are at in science education. You're one of the leading voices defending the teaching of evolution in public schools, so that makes you like enemy number one to a certain brand of religious person, the anti-evolution creationist religious person we were talking about earlier. But you're also, Jeannie, criticized for not going far enough as a science educator, since you fiercely argue that science education, evolution education, doesn't necessarily imply skepticism of God or that you need to be an atheist, since so many religious folks, in fact, do adopt evolution. So my question, does it ever get like completely crazy-making and exhausting that you're attacked really from both sides? You're one of the few lightning rods out there that get it from both ends.
You know, I've got a lot of things to do. I have a staff here at NCSC. This is a nonprofit, is a small business. I have to raise money every year to make that payroll. Frankly, I don't read the blogs. Okay, my staff or other people will sometimes send me links to some of the critics, and I may or may not go and take a look at them. But frankly, my plate is plenty full. Just trying to keep NCSC solvent and trying to do the things that people join us to do, and helping my staff to deal with the flare-ups and the legal cases and all of that. You know, I have, in fact, in some articles and in some public appearances, and there's some stuff on YouTube that people can find, I have addressed this issue of atheism equating to evolution. And, you know, the critics out there who claim to be scientifically oriented certainly are very bad empiricists, because it is just empirically wrong that evolution requires atheism or equates to atheism. There are too many people out there who are scientists, who are people of faith, who accept evolution but also are religious. There are too many theologians out there who clearly are people of faith and whose day job it is to think about these kinds of things, who also find that evolution is perfectly compatible with their religious views. So just empirically, you don't have to choose. Now, what tends to happen at this point is...
Well, that might just mean that, and not that you don't have to choose, but that those folks don't choose. In other words, maybe they're just inconsistently applying, you know, the findings of evolution.
DJ, this is what I mean by you shift the goalpost. The statement usually is made, well, evolution and religion are incompatible. And then, of course, the response to that is, well, not always.
Because look at these religious evolutionists, yeah.
Yeah, here are a bunch of people who accept both evolution and faith. It depends upon what your faith tradition is. Obviously, some Christian faith traditions are incompatible with evolution. Sure, you know, we know that. That's part of my day job. But not all. At which point, the goalposts get moved and people say, yes, but they're being inconsistent, or yes, but there's something wrong with those people. Well, that's a second argument, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who say, well, of course, it is possible to be a person of faith, and, you know, that's not what I meant, but that is what they said.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that... you need to look at the variety of Christian views out there regarding evolution. Some of them are absolutely incompatible with evolution and with what we would consider standard science, and, you know, so be it. But there's a huge range of Christian views out there. And, you know, DJ, the thing that I find almost amusing when I do look at some of these blogs, I see a lot of comments saying things like, I just don't understand how somebody like fill in the blank, Ken Miller or whatever, how somebody like X can possibly be a Christian and an evolutionist. And, you know, when Mike Dembski says, I can't possibly understand how somebody could come up with a natural explanation for the bacterial flagellum, we say, aha, this is an argument from ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody says, I can't understand why a Christian can accept evolution, that is an argument from ignorance.
They're basically saying, I don't know why he can believe in God and evolution at the same time. Therefore, I know that he is either dishonest or inconsistent, etc., right?
Yeah, or worse adjectives than that isn't right. applied, which is fairly juvenile, but whatever. And, you know, my response is, okay, an argument from ignorance is hardly a solid argument.
Mm.
But of course, you know, to me, my background is in anthropology. It's physical anthropology, so I'm really a biologist. But, you know, I had all this archaeology and cultural anthropology and stuff. So I do have a broader background than most biologists in this kind of area.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of my most interesting courses that I took as a... I can't remember, it probably was an undergraduate, was a course in comparative religion, which really was fascinating because it gave me an idea about the range of things that human beings, you know, and this includes tribal religions as well as world religions, the range of things that human beings are concerned about, which they classify as religious. You know, there seems to be a real, religion seems to be very easily learned behavior in Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, it's been shown by many investigators that there are a lot of adaptive functions that religion serves in human societies. Whether you agree with religion or you think this is a good thing or a bad thing, it reinforces the us-them kind of feelings and any number of other things that you can list.
Yeah, it provides all sorts of, on the one hand, social benefits, but it has destructive outcomes as well, religion. Yeah,
it can, just like any other ideology. Mm. I mean, you know, the thing that I think many of the critics...
You're talking about the scientific critics who think that you're too soft on religion.
Yeah, I mean, right, exactly. I think they don't really understand religion very well. I think they may know a lot about Christian fundamentalism, but they don't really know much about Christianity, and they really know very little about religion with a capital R.
Mm.
The thing is, religion with a capital R, if you're going to look at, if you're going to stand way back and just look at the planet, if you look mm-hmm. at human beings all over the planet, and not just American fundamentalist Christians, but, you know, what is that guy down in sub-Saharan Africa living in a village as a horticulturalist, or, you know, what is that, you know, traditional Eskimo thinking, et cetera. Human beings all over, what does capital R religion mean to people? It's not really about explaining the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really about telling you where the forest came from and how Grand Canyon was cut and like that.
It's more about experience, right? It's more about...
Not even that. I mean, it's a religion with a capital R, looking at it as a human cultural pattern, is a way of linking people to... I won't say a supernatural because that's too broad, but a non-material reality, if you will, a non-empirical reality, something which is very easily learned and is apparently learned in all cultures. All cultures seem to have some belief and there's something other than the material world in which we live. And that can be gods, or that can be animistic spirits, or that could be the ancestor spirits. It could be any number of things. Christianity is full of it, but so are tribal religions. I mean, you know, everybody seems to have some sort of idea that there's something other than this world that we inhabit.
Incidentally, I predict you'll be taken out of context there. It will be fun when we see on the internet that Eugenie Scott said Christianity is full of it. So you're talking about religion having this... effect on people where it just connects them with what, you know, psychologists of religion call the numinous or whatever, the feeling of the there and then, that there's more to life than just the material world.
It's a great deal of it. And
but
sometimes
you,
this
but
includes
you,
an afterlife.
Right.
Sometimes this includes proscriptive behaviors. Not all religions are about ethics and morals, by the way, but sometimes that's included, more often than not. It also includes feelings that you have for people who have died. And, I mean, you know, religion is so much more than how was the world created.
Right, and it's a hard nut to crack. You know, religious studies folks spend careers just trying to define the darn thing. What is religion? That's a research project. That's a kind of a career in itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure. And the conflict, if there, and you know, one can imagine, is really between traditional religion dealing with supernatural, if you will, kinds of phenomenon, and other philosophies like humanism,
mm-hmm.
which serves the same sort of purpose of connecting people together in a community, giving people prescriptions for how to behave, giving them a feeling of a meaning for life, and so forth. There are secular philosophies and there are religious philosophies which deal with things that human beings think are very important. And these are independent of science.
And that's the conflict that you see happening. It's not the conflict between science and religion. It's between religious philosophies and secular philosophies, both of which touch on the same sets of human needs. But science.
And that's where the conflict should be.
Yeah, science is outside of that. But you yourself, your worldview, if I could use, you know, such a loaded term, is itself informed by science. You are a naturalist or a materialist.
Exactly.
And
I love the verb that you use because it's one that I've used as well. And the verb you used was informed by science.
Mm.
And it's not a subtle distinction. It is a critical distinction. I used an analogy of a group of flowers. Some of which were, you know, the flowers being different religions or different secular philosophies, and the flowers are in competition with each other, you know, for light, for sunlight, for rain, for fighting against the weeds, whatever. The soil that supports all those flowers is science.
Hmm.
There are religious views which are informed by science. There are secular philosophies like mine which are informed by science. The flowers are in competition with each other. They're not in competition with the soil.
Mm.
Okay, the soil, the substratum, if you will, science is a way of knowing about the natural world which can inform one's philosophy of life. It certainly has informed mine, but it certainly has informed those of the evangelical Christians I know as well.
Mm.
But to say that the argument is between science and religion is like saying the argument is between the soil and the flower. No, the argument is among the flowers, and let's keep it that way.
Your analogy there makes sense to me. I could wrap my head around it, but I think that's the minority view in that the people who attack you from both sides, neither of those groups see it that way. So you're like, you're in this middle ground, or, you know, wherever you are ideologically, you're getting it from both sides, and therefore you have the minority view. I mean, the fundamentalists agree with the new atheists, so-called, in that they both sides agree that science and religion are in conflict. And you have the minority view, at least among those audiences, saying, no, science is the soil, religious philosophy and secular philosophy, those are the flowers. Pretty analogy, I get it. But, you know, a lot of scientists say, wait a minute, Jeannie, religion makes testable claims. It's fair ground. Evolution strongly implies, if not demands, atheism, because if a God existed, the universe would be very different and measurably different. You know, there are those, I know you're familiar, who say God, the God claim itself is a scientific claim.
Well, that's a whole lot of things to deal with. The first one is whether I'm in a minority. I don't think so. I do a lot of lecturing on campuses and universities around the country, and I get an awful lot of people from the science departments coming up to me saying, oh, that makes sense. I never really thought of it that way. And I've had this happen over and over and over.
Mm.
If you picture in your mind, and here we are in Radio Land, picture a bell curve, a normal distribution. We don't know how tall the middle is, but I think it's probably pretty safe to say that there's a normal distribution out
mm-hmm.
there. I have no data for this, of course, so this is purely my own impressions. But what you're saying is that the ends of that means the fundamentalists on the one end and the the more extreme atheists on the other end are the majority.
Right.
I don't think so.
Right.
I think there's more of us in the middle.
Okay, I understand what you're getting at in that regard. The second comment I was making in my long-winded question was about this, God as a scientifically testable claim, and that's also, I guess, a fringe kind of position.
I think that is a position that requires you defining what you mean by God and what kind of God and what's your understanding of science.
Mm.
Now, to me, the heart of science as it's practiced today is methodological naturalism, that we restrict ourselves to explaining the natural world using natural causes, which is why we can say to the Henry Morris and the Michael Behe's of the world, no, you're not playing the right game. You're trying to bring a supernatural cause and still call it science. You can't do that. You
mm-hmm.
have to deal with natural causes only.
Mm-hmm.
But then the flip side of that particular coin is that also, if you accept methodological naturalism as the real hallmark or foundation of modern science, that also means that you can't say, therefore, science proves there is no God. And the reason for that is it is simplifying greatly, but that's what science really is most understandable when you do that. When you talk about science, you're talking about testing your explanations. Okay. The only way, the way you test your explanations is you have to hold constant certain variables. If your view of God is that God is omnipotent, there is no way you can hold the effort. You can't hold the efforts of that kind of a God constant.
Mm.
Most Christians believe in an omnipotent God, in which case God's actions are outside of science. We cannot say God does or does not act.
So by definition, God is outside the bounds of science then?
Yeah. I don't happen to believe in a God. But and I'm sure, and we could maybe rule out if a concept of God is someone who lives underneath my desk and appears on Wednesdays, and then I look on Wednesday and there's no God there. Well, I've just ruled out that kind of God.
Hmm.
But I don't think that's most people's concept of God.
Hmm.
And again, I mean, you really need to keep reminding folks that that's not really why people believe in God. I mean, they're
mm-hmm.
not believing in God because they think that God is going to explain how the world works. I mean, God is important in other ways to people.
Yeah, God means more to folks than scientific explanations of human origins. But I think to a sliver of Christians or fundamentalists in general, I think a lot of belief is actually argued into based on kind of shoddy science, pseudoscience, Answers in Genesis type folks, junk science.
Yeah, I think certainly the kinds of pronouncements that you get in creation science and the stuff you get from the intelligent design crowd, these are fact claims which have just been proved wrong.
Mm.
I mean, and I've been very loud about pointing that out all my life, and so have other people here. I mean, we don't excuse people using shoddy science just because they're placing it in a religious context.
Mm.
That said, we sort of pull back at that point because we want to deal with science. The theologians that we deal with and the religious people we deal with, they can get on the case of these same fundamentalist Christians for their bad theology.
Mm.
And they will.
You attack the bad science, and the mainline Christians attack what they think are the bad theology. I want to circle back to what we were talking about, God being testable or not.
Depends on what kind of God you're talking about.
Exactly. And even if the kind of God a lot of folks believe in is beyond the bounds of science, not testable, is it legitimate for someone to remain skeptical of it? Because if there's no evidence against it or for it, it seems to me that's a perfectly good reason to withhold belief.
I always feel uncomfortable defending the religious views of religious people, because I'm not religious, and it'd really be more effective to have these people speak in their own right. But I know religious people who would agree with a number of the atheists. Somebody like Vic Stenger, who would say, "Well, a God who does A, B, C, and D, couldn't possibly exist. Therefore, there's no God." And they would say, well, yes, I would agree with you, but that's not the kind of God I believe in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this again gets us back to that argument from ignorance. A lot of the atheist critics just sort of throw up their hands and say, I don't understand how they can believe in God. Well, maybe what you need to do is talk to somebody and find out what kind of God they believe in and why they do. But that said, there are lots and lots of Christians out there who are not as reflective as some of the friends that I have made in my job over the years. A lot of Christians who really do have a view that my, I think, more philosophically sophisticated Christian friends would just roll their eyes at, the Sistine Chapel, you know, white guy with the beard reaching mm-hmm. down, touching the outstretched hand of Adam. I mean, that kind of view of an anthropomorphic mm-hmm. God is still believed in by a lot of people.
By millions of Americans who believe that God intervenes in their life on a daily basis, will increase their paycheck, will heal their maladies, you know, of the supernatural, and therefore, in that sense, a kind of testable God. But my
Well, except that unfortunately, because that is an omnipotent power, it isn't really testable.
Well, all I was getting at is if someone makes the claim that God did X, you can look to see if X happened, and
that doesn't mean God did X.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to have about $250,000 more dollars in 2011. Believe me, and if I get it, I'm not going to say it's because I prayed to God.
Mm.
If I don't get it, let's say I was a praying person. Let's say I prayed to God for NCSC's budget to be increased by $250,000 in 2011. Any of you rich people out there remember we need this? And I get it. So I could either say, yes, God answered my prayer. If I don't get it, that doesn't mean that God doesn't love me.
That he's capricious or as in
or
fact...
Or there's another reason for him not giving it to me.
Right. That's the great justificatory scheme. You know, God always answers prayer. Sometimes he just says no. Look, let me try to, you know, zero in on this because you and I can easily have one of those fun and invigorating conversations just about God, and that wouldn't serve us even though I would enjoy it. What I was getting at is really trying to connect it to the skeptics movement as opposed to just the science education work that you've done such effect for many years. So the skeptics community, there are a number of new voices in the skeptics movement, but not that this is new because this argument's been happening in the skeptics movement for decades itself, but there are a number of new voices who talk God a lot as part of skepticism. They say
skepticism includes skepticism about religion.
Exactly.
Many of these people.
And what I'm interested in is if you say science can't disprove God, and I agree, does that mean that it's unwarranted for a skeptic to say, well, it can't disprove God, science, neither can it prove God, therefore I'm a skeptic because there's no evidence one way or the other, it's a faith claim, etc. There are some skeptics on the opposite side who say, oh no, it's out of bounds. Skeptics can't talk God because it's outside the bounds of science, therefore outside the bounds of skepticism.
Well, I think you've sort of answered the by the way you framed it, you've answered the question. Someone who says, well, I see no evidence for God, I don't see any evidence against God, it's obviously outside of science, I'm going to be skeptical, I'd say fine. But what does this have to do with the skeptics movement? What does this have to do with skepticism as a group of people who are trying to increase the public understanding of science and the appreciation of science and a more critical thinking perspective, et cetera, et cetera? You just admitted it's outside of science, so therefore it's not part of our purview.
So there's not room in skepticism for all comers, the people who say, I'm skeptical of religion and here's my case, because that's a philosophical case and not a kind of an evidence-based case.
I'd say it's an ideological claim,
mm-hmm.
and if science is not an ideology, like we were talking about, and as I've talked about before, science can influence ideological, philosophical, religious positions and all that, but science itself is not an ideology. It's a body of information, and it's a methodology. But ideologies, I think, are going to get in the way of this bigger mission that skepticism has, of helping the public understand science and being more critically thinking. I mean, there's a lot of skeptics these days, alas, who are libertarians.
Mm-hmm.
IAN, libertarianism, this is an ideology. It's a political and economic ideology.
And they might even argue that skepticism, consistently applied, will get you to libertarianism.
Well, they may claim that, but why should we waste our time arguing about whether skepticism should be libertarian or capitalistic or humanistic, or let's leave the ideologies out. We've got a big job on our hands in just trying to improve the public understanding of science. Obviously, I'm not saying slam the door in front of anybody who wants to use skepticism to challenge religion. I just think we've got better things to do, and I think it reflects a more accurate picture of how science works if we leave out the ideological claims. And I want to just make a quick little comment about history, because if you remember. You don't remember, you're much younger. But originally, Paul Kurtz started the skeptics, mm-hmm. or helped to give birth to, it was not just Paul, but Paul and Sagan and a whole bunch of other good folks, gave birth to the skeptics movement and simultaneously a form of humanism. And he kept those two separate for a very long time.
But out of his own mouth, he says that division of labor was really a function of, there was a fundraising agenda. One, you don't want to upset, religious supporters of skepticism. But also a kind of non-overlapping magisterian skepticism or division of labor, just because the organizations were more nimble or effective if they didn't try to do everything. There were other skeptics, though, involved in those conversations, and while I don't remember them, I've done hundreds of hours of oral biography of these folks, so I've heard all the different arguments from the different sides. Other folks argued, it is improper for, say, PSYCOP to treat religious claims for exactly the philosophy of science reasons you have been giving in our conversation.
And elsewhere.
Yeah, and elsewhere, yeah. But those waters have muddied quite a bit in recent years. Michael Shermer speaks as a skeptic about religion lots. James Randi and Michael Shermer both have come out as enthusiastic brights. PSYCOP and the Council for Secular Humanism kind of came together, joined forces in a sense. And even PSYCOP, I keep saying PSYCOP, I should say Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, even they publish in their skeptical magazine issues devoted to science and religion, their most popular issues. So those lines have been blurred. Do you think it's undercut the effectiveness of skepticism? Or another way to ask is, are you optimistic about the future with such muddy waters?
They started out for a variety of reasons, but as you pointed out, some of them for very good philosophy of science reasons, as separate movements. Paul Kurtz at one point tried to bring them back together again when he started CFI and the economies of scale, and because mm-hmm. he thought that they really were the same thing anyway, an awful lot of us pushed back on that very
mm-hmm.
hard
mm-hmm.
And are continuing to push back on that. DJ, let's think about born-again skepticism, okay?
I love it. Sign me up.
Maybe this is a new movement that I and people who agree with me might start promoting, to sort of go back to the roots of skepticism.
The philosophy of science roots of skepticism.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Whereas in the very early days, the concern was not with challenging ideologies, but with challenging claims challenging extraordinary claims. And, claims of the paranormal has one implication, but mm-hmm. extraordinary claims is broader.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, let me finish with this then. If you want to go back to the glory days, the golden age of contemporary skepticism. And that's appealing to me in a sense, not only because I romanticized what fun it must have been in the 70s with Uri Geller and all that stuff.
And Sagan and all of our luminaries.
But
and people like Martin Gardner, who of course is a theist,
who was a fideist, although he got his lumps and stood up for them. You know, he didn't take his toys and go home when people said he was wrongheaded for being a fideist.
Right.
So, to focus on my final question, though, those glory days of skepticism, where there was a focus just on extraordinary claims. And the harm that undue credulity in extraordinary claims could cause people.
And critical thinking. And
promotion of critical thinking and promotion of general science appreciation, science education. Those prongs that we've discussed in our conversation today. Well, if that's a legitimate kind of goal of born-again skepticism, why isn't God an extraordinary claim that undue credulity in causes harm that merits being challenged? Do you see where I'm coming from?
Because of the philosophy of science issue, and practical issues as well, of course. I mean, I've always, you know, just like with evolution, there's a philosophy of science issue and a practical down-to-earth issue in terms of cooperating with the people of faith to get things done.
Right.
Similarly with skepticism, there are those of us who, in our understanding of science, don't see how you can get anywhere with testing claims of an omnipotent power like most people's conception of the Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now sliding over to the more practical part, let's put our efforts where we can actually see some results and some positive results. We've got lots of work to do to dissuade the members of the public from believing in things which are harmful to them, in helping them understand and appreciate science, and helping them become better critical thinkers. I mean, you know, if your real cause in life is promoting atheism, fine. Go ahead and promote atheism. You know, it's not my interest, but, you know, go for it. But do you have to wear your skeptic's hat when you do it?
Mm.
Do you have to wear your scientist hat when you do it? I don't think so.
And there are atheist organizations set up to advance that agenda. The skeptic movement is broader than that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Part of it is, I think, just sort of figuring out what your interests are and where they lie. And in general, most people can compartmentalize their lives. I mean, You may like kids, so you're a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout leader, and you may also think that something like you know, curing blindness is important, so you join the Lions Club, and you know, you don't confuse those two. You know, you have different interests in your life, and so you have different ways of meeting those interests. You may like music, and so you might join a Baroque quartet if you play cello. But you don't confuse that with the Lions Club.
Mm.
I mean, we all have a variety of interests. So if your interest is promoting atheism, great. Go to one of the atheist organizations and help them. If you're interested in helping people be critical thinkers, fine. You know, we'd love to have your help as when you want to work on that sort of issue. Come and join the skeptics.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate your time getting into these topics. It seems like there's more interest in this. I think that's a good sign when a movement has matured enough for people at the grassroots to be talking about these strategic questions, sometimes seemingly all the time. Well, I think that's a good sign suggesting that the movement's growing and growing up. So I really appreciate your time.
And like all adolescents, as it were, or young adults, there's going to be a great diversity of opinions, and you know, maybe the movement will mature into a more focused orientation, and we'll get more things done.
So that maybe suggests that you're not just full throttle optimistic, but you're not throwing in the towel either.
Oh, DJ, how could I have been at NCSE for 26 however many years and not have a pathological optimism.
I love it. Cursed by optimism. But yes, in order to do this line of work, to push the boulder up the hill, even though you know it's just going to be shoved down again, you have to be steeped in that kind of optimism.
Yeah, but every once in a while, like Kitzmiller, we get one over.
Absolutely.
So, Eugenie, actually, we get a whole lot more over than you'd be, than you'll hear about. But anyway.
I know that's true. Eugenie, such a pleasure. Thanks very much for your time.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to For Good Reason. Views expressed on the show aren't necessarily the JREF's views, and questions and comments on today's show can be sent in to info@forgoodreason.org. For Good Reason is produced by Thomas Donnelly and recorded from St. Louis, Missouri. For Good Reason's music is composed for us by Emmy Award-nominated Gary Stockdale. Christina Stevens contributed to today's show. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.